Just like to start this program by acknowledging that it's being produced on stolen land. That's the stolen land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty's never been ceded, and I'd just like to pay my respects to the elders of this land, past and present. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio. That's 855 AM on your dial, or 3cr.org.au, where you can tune in online. My name is Tilda Joy, and today at 3CR we're bringing you the Binary Busting Broadcast. That's 7 hours of trans and gender diverse radio. And for this hour, I'd like to bring you two pretty special interviews. Later on, we're going to have a panel of trans health practitioners and just talking about some of the gaps in what trans people are facing at the moment and how the communities themselves can kind of work to transform that. But first, we're going to hear from Whit Gorry and Keith Quayle from the Incarcerated Trans and Gender Diverse Community Fund. They've been raising some money over the last few months to support trans people inside of prisons and on their way out back into the broader community. They've been doing some really great work, and I'm really excited about bringing you this interview. So let's throw over to that now. All right. Hi there, everyone. We're joined here by Whit Gorry and Keith Quayle. Thanks so much for making the time today. I thought we could just start off with some introductions.
Thanks. Yes, I'm Whit Gorry. I am a white trans social worker based in Nam. I've been involved in the Incarcerated Trans and Gender Diverse Community Fund since it started. When did we kick off? Like last October. But I've been a social worker. Well, I hate the term social worker, but providing support to people who are criminalised for the past 10 years, pretty much, almost. Yeah, and so I also support trans and gender diverse people who are in custody and post-release. Yeah, and so I'm here on Gunai Kurnai country today, which is where I live.
Great, thanks for that, Whit. And how about you, Keith?
Thank you. My name's Keith Quayle. I'm a Mayingumpa Barkindji identifying man who grew up in Darug country. I guess my experience that I bring to the committee, I was incarcerated when I was 24 years old, and pretty much up until this August I finished the good behaviour bond, but it's been a continual process of going in and out of custody since 24. I joined the committee late last year. I run New South Wales Community Advocates for People in Prisons. So we work all over Sydney. Yeah, it's pretty much a service that provides visits and material and other in-kind assistance.
That's awesome. So how did this like the Incarcerated Trans and Gender Diverse Community Fund, how did that kind of come to be in October last year?
Yeah, so it started, it's been something that me and a few other people have been discussing for a while, and it sort of came to fruition as well from conversations with lawyers and different people supporting trans and gender diverse people in custody, including myself, that there was, you know, a real need for specific support and particularly financial and material aid for people and, you know, that could benefit in terms of not only while people are in custody but also to assist people to get out. So things like, you know, accommodation for bail or, you know, supporting people, say, if they get locked up to, you know, assist with a bit of rent payment so that, you know, people can hold their accommodation and have somewhere to get out to, right through to providing, you know, binders, bras and underwear, you know, all different things depending on what the individual needs. So we kicked off a GoFundMe, which initially we were just like thinking, you know, we'll just get a few grand. And then we realised that it was really a Kickstarter for a much more ongoing community fund for people, and the amount of support that came through within a 24-hour period and then within the week was just wild. You know, we'd made $30,000 for the fund in about 5 days. Yeah, we certainly didn't expect that level of support, and it's been amazing to know that and so amazing to tell people in custody, trans people in custody, that there's so much support in the community.
Well, it must have been a lovely shock to have raised so much money in such a short amount of time. I think it speaks to the just instinctive kind of reality, you know, as a trans woman myself, you know, it's my worst nightmare having to go to prison, you know, like, and I think a lot of us, you know, have imagined it. You know, I've never been there myself, but a lot of us are also working in criminalized industries like sex work and things like that. And that's kind of how we end up there. But I thought maybe we could touch on, because, you know, like I've never been to a prison, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners wouldn't really understand what the realities are for trans and gender diverse people inside prisons.
Like, from my perspective, you know, being incarcerated as a gay man, you know, I can only really speak of my lived experience in terms of that question. But if you are found out to be anything other than the status quo of what you're supposed to be in jail, and that is, I don't know any other word that I can think of at the moment, but like a big bully, you know, or somebody, you know, I don't like to use that word, you know, because I think that, you know, a lot of these, you know, people that are in custody are very angry, you know, for righteous reasons, you know. I mean, that's pretty much how I got in touch with the criminal justice system, is by my anger. And, you know, I would take it out on people such as police. The day-to-day realities for anybody in custody is pretty dire, you know, and you know, there's not a lot of options. So if you can think of it from a broad perspective of everybody, you know, going into custody and experiencing these issues, I would like you to then imagine trans and gender diverse people who already experience structural discrimination on the outside.
Yeah, I guess, like, in terms of the people I support, above 95% of people that end up in, trans people that end up in prison, vast majority are trans women. Nearly everyone ends up in a men's prison. So being a woman trying to survive in a men's prison, it's literally the daily threat of physical, psychological or sexual violence. Like, that is the daily reality. Also, when we look at, like, the trajectories for trans people to end up in custody, and, you know, Tilda, you mentioned that, you know, particularly in terms of where trans people may be in employment that's criminalized because of the huge structural barriers that particularly trans women experience in terms of accessing different forms of employment, or, you know, who may be in employment that's criminalized, you know, that places greater risk of ending up in the prison system or ending up under the eyes of the police. And then, say you do get criminalized, you try and come out and get a job. When you're already someone who has so many structural barriers to employment, you add criminalization into that, and it's like almost impossible, right? Like, it's a huge hurdle to overcome without support. Not to mention, you know, while people are in custody, a lot of trans people I have contact with don't have family support. And if they do, the support that their family can offer is very minimal, or, you know, they've come into prison already experiencing poverty, already experiencing homelessness. You know, and then to get out of prison, you need to have housing. You know, particularly if you want to get parole, there's no way you're going to get parole unless you have housing. If you're, say, you know, also have family who are highly criminalized, you can't go and stay with your family because parole aren't going to let you out. So it's just a cycle of keeping people in the system and keeping people criminalized, and it's the amplification of that for trans and gender diverse people who, you know, who already experience, particularly if you're Aboriginal or you're a trans woman of color, or you have a disability, or, you know, you're already experiencing homelessness, you're not going to come out of the prison system in a better spot. You're going to come out worse off.
Absolutely. I mean, any of those things on their own, just being trans and getting a house or a job, it's hard enough. You know, I remember getting my first job at Hungry Jack's when I was 14, you know, and I had to tick a box whether I'd been in prison or not. You know, it'd be impossible. So, yeah, thank you so much for the work you're doing. And I think you're right about that application effect. And you mentioned earlier Wit about the ways that this impacts brother boys and sister girls and the Indigenous community more broadly, who are overwhelmingly, absolutely overrepresented in prisons across the entire continent. What way does that kind of play into the work that you're doing at the moment, and the colonial nature of the prisons themselves, and how that interacts with the people you're working with?
Yeah, so I guess I would like to start from an Indigenous perspective. I think it's well known that most Indigenous cultures around the world, have some form of a two-spirit identity. And, certainly in my culture and other cultures, that I've researched and, that is widely well known, it's generally accepted that these people are healers and truth tellers. I believe that Western influence of gender and colonization, has muddied the waters on what truth is, and I feel like we're all on this journey to discover that truth. In terms of the systematic oppression, I think that the starting point would be to assist the people in our communities that are the most marginalized, and assist in the betterment of these people and in their everyday lives, transgender diverse people. And as Whit mentioned, it's overwhelmingly sister girls and Aboriginal trans women in custody. From an Indigenous person's perspective, the colonial idea of power, introduces the very basic and universal classification of race and gender, and it's replacing the Indigenous understanding of trans and gender diverse people and our practices for the clear systematic divide of superiority and who's inferior to those people. So it's in the best interest for the system to keep it as a heteronormative system. For me personally, going into custody, you did find that there was a clear divide, a clear path, it's either to conform or take your own life, and we see this with the cases of the overrepresentation of Aboriginal deaths in custody, and seeing that, not one officer is being charged. My cousin Mark Quayle, who was one of those deaths and is mentioned in the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. So, as an advocate for abolition, it is very personal for me.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Keith. So I was wondering if we could turn now to just where things are at with the fund, and what you're hoping to kind of do over the next little while. You said kind of this felt like a bit of a Kickstarter for something that's a bit more long term. So where do you see things going over the next period?
I think, obviously, we've only been in existence for what, 6 months, 5 months now. So we want to, create it as sustainable and, an ongoing resource for trans and gender diverse people who are inside and those coming home. So really just building up our connections more, getting the word out across and all states and territories,
of support.
And it is really tricky to actually connect with people. A lot of the
in custody,
the ways that people find out about the fund is through word of mouth, through the Inside Out newsletter. I don't know if you're aware of the Inside Out newsletter. They're right across so-called Australia. They are a newsletter for LGBTI identified people in the prison system, and they do that completely voluntary, and I think it's at quarterly, so they do 4 issues a year. And it's just such a, I don't know, Keith, if you ever, did you ever get Inside Out when, was it around when you were inside?
I'd never seen it, no.
Might have been before, come after, but yeah, it's just people can find out information about different supports. So we advertise in there, for example. So that's one way of connecting with people. But also really conscious of wanting to connect directly with people and not we're also a bit cautious about connecting through services, because sometimes services have a tendency to just want to not do their jobs, and even though they may have funding to assist people. So we're really conscious of making sure that we're talking to the person that's receiving the support directly, and facilitating that support with them directly, rather than going through services that may have their own agenda or wanting to sort of piggyback off the fund, for lack of a better term. But, yeah, I mean, our focus really is building connections, building sustainability within the community, having this as a resource to support people to get out and stay out.
Well, we might wrap it up in just a sec. I was just wondering, do either of you have any shout-outs you want to give now, or any final messages?
For me, you know, I guess I just want to quickly go back on, you know, to what Whit was saying and the importance of community. I think that, you know, that's why I got involved, because, you know, this is a grassroots movement. I believe that, you know, we have the power to, you know, to change this system, you know. And recently, if you've seen the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, the Department of Home Affairs, you know.
Hell yeah, that was so radical. It was amazing.
Like, it's not just, you know, it's not just people that have been in prison or people that are supporting people in prisons that are aware of this issue. You know, this issue is across our whole community.
Also,
and, you know, as you know for yourself, you know, when you are in work, such as sex work, you know, you are targeted by the police tenfold, you know, so I'm really impressed, you know, with the wider community, I guess, getting involved. And I just want to thank the Department of Home Affairs, because they did donate the excess legal funds to the ITG fund. And also, yeah, anyone listening that's in custody, shout out to them.
The Rainbow Door is a free, culturally safe, specialist helpline for all LGBTIQA+ Victorians. The helpline provides information, support, and referral from experienced peer workers on issues including mental health, family violence, relationships, suicide prevention, and sexual assault. For information, support, and referral, call the Rainbow Door on 1-800-729-367. That's 1-800-729-367, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day. Switchboard is a 3CR supporter.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio. That's 8:55 a.m. on your dial. And my name is Tilda Joy, and I'm bringing you part of the Binary Busting broadcast. That's 7 hours of trans and gender diverse radio in the lead up to Trans Day of Visibility. Before the break, we heard from Whit Gorry and Keith Quayle from the Incarcerated Trans and Gender Diverse Community Fund. And if you wanted to make a donation to them, head over to 3cr.org.au/binarybusting. And we've got some details up there about how you can make a bank deposit to them and help them in their effort. Next, we're going to head over to a panel of trans healthcare practitioners. And, well, we'll let that play itself out. But I think it's a pretty good interview, so see you on the other side. All right. Hi, welcome everyone. Thanks for joining the panel today. I thought we'd just start with a quick round of intros. So I'll just start from my left on the video call, and we'll go with Star Lady. Hey, Star Lady, who are you and what do you do?
Hey, I'm the program manager at the Zoe Bell Gender Collective, and I use she, her pronouns.
Fantastic. And we've got Elle.
Hi, I'm Elle. I am the peer navigator working for your community health as part of the Trans and Gender Diverse Health Service there. And I use she, her pronouns.
Thanks, Elle. And Alex?
Hi, I'm Alex, she, her pronouns. I'm a student psychotherapist and sort of a community mutual aid member and participant, as well as someone who also experiences her own mental health intersection.
Excellent. Thank you. And Asiel?
Hi, I'm Asiel. My pronouns are they, them. I'm a GP at Northside Clinic and an academic at the University of Melbourne.
Awesome. Hey, so thanks everyone so much for meeting today. I might just introduce myself. My name's Tilda Joy. I'm a first year student nurse. And I thought maybe we could start off with like talking about just as a group of trans people, what our experiences have been like accessing healthcare at the moment and how that might have changed over the last little while, and what kind of gaps we can identify at the moment as in the provision of healthcare for trans people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think over the course of the pandemic in particular, what we've seen in primary care is just an absolute overflow of primary health resources. And there's a lot of, I think, complex interactions between that. There's obviously a great demand and growing community need, which we've known kind of time and time again. With COVID in particular, I think a lot of those community supports have just been completely severed and people have really felt the isolation. The difficulty is that the services have not quite kept up with the demand. So whenever I'm seeing patients, clients, I often have to give a long list of like door knocking to see who has capacity to actually just respond. And similarly, if people require care that's a little bit more intensive, accessing tertiary care, accessing mental health care, hospitals, public services is just such a rigmarole. It really requires strong advocacy, not only from primary health providers, but also self-advocacy for a lot of the members of the trans and the diverse community, which if you're in a vulnerable population, you're obviously, your resources are completely drained around it. So it's been a really difficult time from our experience.
Absolutely. And Elle, you're also working in primary healthcare, maybe not in a different role to Aziel, not a GP, but what have you seen over the last little while?
I mean, trans healthcare has always been pretty, I guess, you know, good trans doctors are always in demand. If someone knows that a doctor is trans friendly or uses, you know, the informed consent model, everybody knows who they are in the trans community. And so it kind of like can get a bit, I guess, hard to get in with doctors who are known as good doctors. And then there are other doctors who are, I guess, you know, learning. So, you know, we are slowly getting more doctors who can provide, I guess, you know, gender affirming care. But it is a long, slow process. And I guess it's, you know, just lots of work. But I guess particularly over the last, I guess, year and a half, I've seen that a lot of people are wanting to access, I guess, gender affirming doctors and access, basically just for general health services. And that demand is actually going up a lot more as opposed to accessing a doctor for just trans-specific healthcare services. It's, I guess, starting to reach a critical point, I guess.
Yeah, and you've been working in trans healthcare for quite a while now, haven't you, Elle?
Yeah, various places, yeah.
And so have you noticed, like, a shift over the, you know, over the years?
I guess, you know, in the past, a lot of, I guess, the trans healthcare, you know, was really around you had a doctor that was maybe a little bit okay with trans stuff, you know, who didn't make you feel uncomfortable, but couldn't do anything for you because they had no knowledge. And so we're kind of seeing the shift more to, I guess, GPs now actually being able to and feeling comfortable to provide gender-affirming care as opposed to referring to specialists.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to acknowledge the history of pathologization on, you know, trans and gender diverse community, and to acknowledge that pathologization is still having a massive impact on the trans community and our access to gender affirming care that puts the health and well-being of the trans and gender diverse community at significant risk. In the last few years, we have been moving towards, or some GPs and the government has been moving towards, models of informed consent around accessing HRT. But, you know, there is a lot of work that needs to happen within the medical industry to depathologize. And there's a lot of work that needs to happen, I guess, in medical education systems to include trans-affirming care. It shouldn't be a specialist care. It's seen as a specialist care, I think, still, but we need all GPs to be taught and to be able and be confident in delivering informed consent. And because until we have health equity, trans and gender diverse health is not going to change. It's not going to improve. And we need more GPs. There are still so few GPs who are willing to do informed consent that it puts, it delays trans and gender diverse people's ability to affirm their identity, which we know is a protective factor. We know is an empowering factor. And until that changes, we won't see great improvements in trans health. But I'd also think, so we've got this history of pathologization, but I also like to acknowledge what I would call, what the ZGBC is calling, a current crisis in trans and gender diverse health. We already had like a levels of crisis around trans people's mental health, like suicidality and self-harm for our community in research is through the roof. And we have like tertiary health systems that I think are not just providing poor care, but they are actually dangerous when trans and gender diverse people enter those systems. They often abuse us or cause significant harms, or they deny us access to those services. And I think we need to hold, the community and the LGBTI sector needs to hold the government and the tertiary mental health system to account. And we need to be demanding changes. Like, it's great, I guess, there's been the Royal Commission into the Victorian mental health system, but I didn't see pathologization as a part of that. I didn't see informed consent as a part of that. And it's given vague recommendations around LGBTI inclusive practice, but it has not named anything around developing trans and gender diverse inclusive practice or what needs to happen. And I think this is outrageous that this is happening. And I mean, we've seen deaths in our community over summer that we need addressed. And I just don't see that it's being addressed. And I don't see that the government's taking this seriously enough.
We certainly have. And I think people who, like, I only had a passing acquaintance with Bridget, who passed away over the summer, but every trans person I think who heard that news was just shattered when it happened. So we definitely need to come to terms with this stuff. Just before we move on to Alex and maybe your thoughts about some of the gaps, I thought just for our listeners at home, I think one or two of them might be cisgender. What is the informed consent model, and what did we have before informed consent?
I suppose historically, a lot of trans and gender diverse identities have been put in this medicalized, pathologized kind of model, where in order for people to access hormone replacement therapy, gender affirmation services, they had to be formally diagnosed, I suppose. And it typically involved a gender assessment by a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and it typically involved a specialist like an endocrinologist to be able to prescribe that hormone replacement therapy. Informed consent in Australia started coming in about 2014, 2015, particularly at Equinox Gender Clinic. And it essentially shifted that focus away from a specialist-based type of assessment and a pathologizing assessment to a more primary care, community-based kind of assessment. And the way that I think about it, it's not even an assessment per se. It's a trans individual coming in, we discuss what the goals of gender affirmation are and how we can best support that particular person. So we're not placing absolutely any value judgment on anyone's identity or gender presentation or gender identity or whatever else it might be. It's very much about working together to support that particular individual in their needs. I would love to hear from Elle's perspective as well. I know you do quite a lot of work in this space. So if there's anything to add, anything to correct, absolutely feel free.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I tend to describe the informed consent model as kind of developing a relationship between you and your GP. A GP is the person who, I guess, takes on the responsibility of prescribing. And so they want to feel comfortable that if something's happening to them that they don't know how to understand, they're finding struggles with, that the GP knows that they'd come back to them and say, hey, this is going on. Is this to do with being on hormones? Is this something that we could have a conversation about? All of the clinicians that I work with, they're all pretty open that, basically if something's happening and you don't know what's happening, come to your GP, go to your GP about it. That's kind of, I guess, the main way that I think about informed consent. And so I guess the other thing about the informed consent model is that it doesn't explicitly rule out the possibility of secondary consultations. And I think that scares a lot of trans people, is thinking that they're going to be, set back if there's a, you know, a secondary consultation is made with another clinician. And I guess, you know, that definitely comes about from the history of pathologization, where, you know, you're kind of told that you can't move forward until you've done this secondary consultation with someone. And I guess, you know, it is scary, but at the same time, you know, it means that your healthcare is actually being tailored towards you. And that's kind of, I guess, the most important thing about informed consent. It's that, yeah, you're fully informed about what's happening.
So just, rewinding a little bit, Alex, I'm sure you've got some thoughts on kind of what gaps in accessibility and service look like in healthcare at the moment. I was wondering if you could expand on, you know, what you've been working on lately.
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, I think the informed consent model, I sort of transitioned just before it kicked in, had to do a pathology model.
Same.
And but part of me actually kind of likes that. It's like, back in my day, I had to do this. It's a brilliant model. It's pretty amazing. It's essentially allowing so many of us to manifest or to become. And I think what the felt sense for me is that it kind of ends there. There's this, like, okay, now I get to be trans. Like, I get to be visible. I get to, like, manifest. I get to become. And then what? It's essentially been a massive gap between any other service of, like, going into hospital or having acute mental health, or also just experiencing what it's like to be complexly impacted every single day by living your identity in a world that isn't entirely friendly. And so I think that, for at least for myself and many of my friends, it's producing complex trauma responses in us. We are getting sicker. The more of us there are, there is a portion of us that are just struggling so deeply within that, and there isn't really available options. And pretty much out of the 20 therapists that I've seen, about two have been, able to hold any space for the complexities of that experience. And I think there's just, I can only really speak from the mental health perspective, is that just like an incredibly large gap. Incredibly appreciative of our medical system for expanding so rapidly and sort of really meeting this need, and so many people being able to access that. And as you're saying before, it's not enough, but I think it opens these other gaps. There's other things in and around surgery. Like, I personally went overseas and had a horrid surgery that I'm now, like, a trans-affirming surgery that went terribly wrong, and basically nothing I can do about it now because it was done overseas, because it was pushed outside of Australia because we don't have adequate access to safe surgery options here. It's pretty limited. One of the other contributing factors to sort of mental health issues and being trans. And I think that begs this question around, if the system is so systemically failing, then how do we as a community respond? I come from the belief that institutional systems are always going to be flawed to some degree. I mean, we can make them better and we can ask them to be accountable, but, like, when we think about complex issues like, the pathology of borderline personality disorder and how difficult that is to treat, and particularly something that's pretty rampant within community, this sort of pathology, like, thrown left, right, and center. And it's like something that I question whether it's even something a therapist could adequately deal with, is when thinking about particularly the deaths in the community, how many people are affected with that pathology, that it's a responsibility in the community. When we're thinking about an attachment regulation disorder or anguish disorder, I think these are better words for it. It's like that we as a community can hold that space probably 10 times better than the institutions, or waiting, dying for the institutions to catch up to us. And in the interim, what can we as a community do? And I mean, I think looking at other countries, the necessity for mutual aid and how radical that can be, like my perspective is that we create our own solution rather than waiting, rather than dying for the system to catch up. Let's generate something, a care model, a respite model, a healing model, a recovery-based model within community and have leadership in recovery. Big concept, not quite sure how we're going to really manage that one, but I mean, what I and a bunch of community members just sort of in response to the emergency over summer was to start the idea of HOML, a House of Mutual Learning, which would be like the original idea is that it's a place. But I think that's going to take quite some time to begin with. It's going to be like a strategy, basically a trans-union within the community and how to resource each other. Who's got something to give and who has a need. And sort of addressing that and then hopefully building towards actually creating a center run by the community for the community rather than some sort of government sort of generously offering us something like, let's just build it to begin with, is my kind of ethos. But, you know, I sort of also question that sort of ethos as well. Like, it is questionable, it is complicated, it is flawed, and it's difficult. And we are a hard group of, we're a hard community to care for. Very good. So,
well, I think it's such a beautiful idea. And I'm a staunch labor unionist myself. And it's music to my ears to hear the principles behind what you're organizing around at the moment and what we hope to get out of it too. So I'm incredibly excited. So I thought we could next move on to as people who have an involvement in institutions that provide health. I know Alex, you're a student psychotherapist. I'm a student nurse. We're kind of going through that onboarding process of being brought into the institution. I'm wondering what kind of barriers trans people face in entering the institution in the first place.
It's kind of a bit hard-hitting. I'm just going back to school after like quite a large crisis within the community and talking to my institution on where I'm at. My own mental health has been deeply impacted by this process, and I approached my university and I was like, look, I'm probably struggling. I'm going to be studying with that struggle, and then how can I struggle and not let go of this course? And they basically offered nothing, and so there is no and nothing. They don't even do basic pronouns. Like, there's no introduction, there's no 101. It's basically the entire responsibility is on me as a student to educate 20 other peers about like the basics of pronouns, and it's so simple, and I hate that it's just as simple as that, but like they're not even doing sort of the fundamental within an institution, and that's this problem, is that as a trans person you kind of have to work 5 to 10 times harder, and it's already hard. And so it's a burden to begin with, and then they give you basically weights to put on your own shoulders. And no wonder, we're not sort of making it up into institutions or like manifesting. Like, it's taken me 2 or 3 years of like severe mental health issues to sort of finally build up the point to get into the system, getting into it, and then realizing it's not very good. And they make me work twice as hard than any other student, and I'm just like exhausted by it. And part of me does want to step away from this. Like, I don't want to exist in an institution that doesn't like strongly support me and advocate for me. But what else are you supposed to do?
Yeah, I've noticed very similar things, being the only trans person in my cohort and studying online via Zoom, and things like that. But also within I think just the institution itself, if we're talking about birth giving, it's always like mothers and she and her, and we're talking about toileting, if a patient has a penis, then they're immediately assumed to be a man and things like that. And even like the whiteness of the institution too, like I noticed they're teaching us about like what, you know, the correct skin color for someone who's well perfused should be. And it's, you know, like pale and pink, which is not necessarily true. As you stand at the intersection here between, you know, transness and being a person of color, what kind of barriers have you noticed as a practitioner within health institutions?
Where do we even start? I mean, a lot of the work that I do now in terms of the academic work is very much around challenging all of those systems of knowledge. I just very vividly remember one of the places that I trained in, you know, people who were in power, people who were kind of the head of that particular institution saying, oh, you know, if you ever showed up to work in a dress, no, none of the patients would respect you, just to be incredibly unprofessional, et cetera, et cetera. Now I make a point to show up every day in the clothing and presentation that makes me feel comfortable, and to hold teaching positions and to get into that educational space in a very similar way. So no other student feels like, you know, there's no trans people in healthcare, or you can't be trans and a healthcare professional, because there's a lot of systemic barriers already kind of put in place. And with that in mind, the other thing that is really difficult to contend with is absolutely that white kind of lens that's layered on top of all of these kind of teaching. So even though there's small leeways that are kind of being made and there's small progress around, I don't think we have a very good answer of how to have a really robust kind of educational system or institution that takes these things into account. We're always very much coming from kind of a cis, heteronormative, patriarchal, white, colonial kind of lens. And anyone who enters not only a teaching institution, but those healthcare environments has to, in a way, kind of subject themselves to it in order to access the care that they need. So I think that's a big, big question that I don't think that the medical system in itself has come up with an answer to. It's something that it constantly needs to be challenged and chipped away kind of bit by bit. And I am hoping that kind of as time progresses that, you know, people from community get into those positions of power, we make more space, we bring people up with us to really allow that institution to change from the inside out. But it's difficult. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of emotional labor to kind of get there.
Certainly does. So maybe Star Lady and Elle, kind of interacting with the health institution, not directly as practitioners, but like, you know, through things like So Bell and being the peer liaison. What's your perspective on like, you know, the challenges it takes for trans people to have a say in their own healthcare?
Well, I think, first of all, I think in acknowledging the poor health outcomes for trans and gender diverse people, it's not a trans issue. It's our society's issue. It's our society's problem. And until our society addresses cis normativity, you know, heteronormativity, you know, all these things, until we until we address those things, our health and well-being outcomes aren't going to change. We need to be people. Our society needs to be addressing transphobia. We need to be addressing the stigma and violence that is occurring towards trans people. We need to be breaking down the rigid gender stereotypes that trans and gender diverse people are forced to, you know, and the gender binary. We need to be breaking these down, and that's happening, needs to happen on a societal level. We also need to be breaking down the barriers for trans and gender diverse people in affirming their gender identity socially, legally, medically, culturally. And until those things change, trans health and our outcomes won't really change. I think in a pathologizing lens, so many mental health practitioners and practitioners work from a lens of that trans people experiencing gender dysphoria. Parts of gender dysphoria, I would really question, is gender dysphoria a symptom of transphobia and cisnormativity within our, you know, within our society? And sometimes the idea of gender dysphoria places the blame and internalizes it within trans people. But are we actually the problem? And I think mental health practitioners, to be really able to support and work with us, need to understand, have an in-depth understanding of the sort of like barriers, obstacles, pressure, discrimination that trans and gender diverse people can face. Because until you know that, how can you unpack that with the trans and gender diverse client? And so we need to be seeing, I think, a much higher level of education, in particular of mental health practitioners into, you know, into what does transphobia look like? What does cis normativity look like? And until you can work from that framework, you're not going to be able to have a genuine therapeutic practice with a trans person if you are saying to them, you know, how can I help you with your problem? Because it's not actually our problem. It's a societal problem. Yes, we might need support in how can we be resilient in the face of this incredible amounts of discrimination and stigma, but it's not our fault that we might have poor mental health. That's society's problem.
Yes, some of the other things that I consider, you know, a barrier to entry into the, I guess, you know, the system is a lot of people tend to treat accessing healthcare as a passive act, you know, as an act where, you know, they attend an appointment with a doctor because they have an issue that the doctor's going to help them fix. And so, you know, often we'll go into appointments expecting that they're going to know best. And I guess parts of that, you know, continue even though we learned that to educate our medical professionals on, you know, pronouns, talking about gender affirmative language. That's been, a big thing that has been put on a lot of trans people. But, and so while that's starting to be the area that's being focused on, you know, we're teaching clinicians how to use affirming languages, it still doesn't, address an issue that a lot of, people expect that their clinician is going to know best for them. And so, you know, they're not asking the questions that they should be asking. They're not saying, hey, this is actually the direction I want to be going in. This is, you know, this is something that I want to talk about before we actually do this. I guess an example of that would be, you know, expecting the doctor to know the best type of medication for yourself. When the truth is that there's multiple different medication types and you should be talking with a doctor about which one's going to be best for you. You should be able to feel comfortable to ask, hey, I've heard some things about this one. Can we talk about, you know, the alternatives, and can we talk about, what's going to work best for me?
Yeah, I think that joint decision making is so important. And yeah, just like this stuff is so important, like has such an impact right down to like reception staff understanding what a dead name might be and why not to say it out loud in a reception room and things like that. And, you know, this is one thing that we can tackle in primary healthcare, you know, but if you're going to see a physio or a psych or, you know, any other number of like specialist services, that's just a training and relationships that, you know, I think remain to be built.
I mean, they don't even know how to, healthcare professionals broadly don't even know how to manage the confidentiality of trans and gender diverse people, and often, you know, out them and put their safety at risk. And they don't know how to manage like trans people's referral letters. Do they write the name on the Medicare card? Do they write their affirmed name and their affirmed pronouns or what? They're not even having those conversations. I would say that broadly, healthcare is really failing trans and gender diverse people, and they don't even have the basics in order, let alone the sort of like really sort of like high level trans and gender diverse practice. And that really needs to change, and it needs to come back to our medical, institutions, you know, giving their students real better training across the board.
So I think you made a very good point earlier, Star Lady, about the emphasis on dysphoria. And I think in an earlier conversation we've talked about, you know, within practice we don't really talk about gender euphoria and what we can do to make trans people happy. And I thought, just going from that, we've talked a lot about the problems in healthcare as an institution, but maybe we could just do a round of like,
what would be the best thing we could see in healthcare, and what's a perfect outcome for trans people that we would like?
I'm just chucking and going, I'd really love to see more peer workers and the peer workforce. So it's like trans and gender diverse people, you know, being able to support members of our community, and for us to be treated with the respect and dignity that we deserve within that system, rather than often peer workers within our health institutions are sort of looked down at and have a much sort of lower status, and we don't have significant amounts of power and authority. So I'd like, you know, health equity and equity for peer workforce.
I guess that being kind of explicitly what my job is, you know, I think that it would be fantastic if there was a lot more people who are doing the exact same work that I do, you know, doing that. Being the face that someone talks to at the first appointment they have at a clinic, you know, where they can actually go, trans people are respected here, trans people are put into important positions. I think, you know, there's a lot more work than just the small amount of peer workers that kind of working now in these professional capacities have. There's just so much more work. And I guess I don't want to discount the role of, I guess, peer support outside of those organizations, because there are plenty of people who, you know, I guess, you know, talking about mutual aid, you know, there are people who, you know, definitely do the same work that myself as a peer navigator does, but aren't employed within an organization. That's important work too, but at the end of the day, those people should be receiving a paycheck for what they do.
Do you want to receive a paycheck, Alex?
Yeah, maybe 3 months full time, 24-hour. Over the last 3 months, I've been sort of practicing under, like, what would I want and how do I be what I want in a system? And when someone said to me, I want to go to hospital, I don't feel safe. And I sat down with them over a cup of tea and said, how do we do that? And we wrote a list. And then I went in with them and I advocated for them next to them each step of the way, like consenting and consulting and checking in both with her and a partner, both trans people in a quite a difficult situation, and advocating for them and getting her a hospital bed in inpatient care, or coming across people and seeing the need and then meeting it, you know, by someone who is trans, who understands the system, who understands the mental health issue itself, someone whose experience has expertise, lived expertise in and around a mental health crisis, and then helping someone activate what they need to sort of do it safely, and providing interim sort of care. Like, people have stayed in my house. I took someone to hospital and they just basically said that they had no available beds and they could wait in the ED after they had made, you know, efforts against living that same day.
Jesus Christ.
Me coming in and had a police call, please check on them, by their therapist, who is also queer. I took them to the hospital and was refused a bed, basically. And I was like, well, you're coming home with me. And I already had someone staying with me. And there's a big question about the efficacy in and around sort of like, well, come on, like, you know, doing that kind of work. And I question my own ethic in that. And I do think it's complicated, but the people that I have supported in over the last 3 months, like the people who took in like crisis care with me, experienced a way better interaction with the mental health system. Each person, you know, got what they needed to get what they needed, and they're on a process of recovery, and they have a network of friends now. Like, they stay at my house, they get someone visiting every single day, they had meals dropped off, they didn't have to think about things. I even organized a massage for someone and myself, because I deserve that too. If I'm going to care that hard, I need to care for myself that hard. And like, I personally would love me right now to come in and look after me, because I've just sort of kind of cooked myself a little bit too hard, you know, as someone who doesn't really receive an income for any of this work. It would be lovely to be looked after in that way, but I know that my network and community can't. My direct friends are kind of like, after a couple of weeks of my own mental health, are kind of struggling. So having someone with a lived trans experience come in and be like, what can we do? And instead of saying no, or saying that's not what we do, it's like, how can we help? That's the thing I'm always looking for, is like, how can we help? And that's not what we have. It's like, you go in and we don't have any beds. We don't have this. You have to go on a waiting list. You have to go cat team. What the fuck is cat team? Like, what have they ever done? Like, how much money are they getting? Like, it's absolutely ridiculous. So, yeah, I want more trans people. I want people fucking standing up for each other and looking, sorry for swearing.
That's fine.
Looking out for each other and radically caring for each other. And I'd love for there to be employment pathways. I'd love for that to be then like how you get a job in the mental health system, not through, you know, years of study under a system, but years of lived experience and modeling sort of actual job pathways. Because, I mean, just some bloody jobs would be great too, you know. There's so many bloody issues. And I think we could quite easily fix it. With the problem we have, we could fix that with the problem, you know. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, that's my...
Yeah, I think every trans person going through that deserves that kind of care, and I'd love to make that real. How about you, Aziel? What would you like to see?
Well, first, I would echo absolutely everything that was already said before around it. There's so many kind of competing priorities that I wouldn't even kind of know where to start. I would 100% agree on just the mental health care system really needs to be thrown out the window and then revamped and kind of recreated around. It's such a problematic system to work in, work with, enter. Just all of those aspects around it make it really, really difficult. And in certain cases, it's kind of the risk factor even in and of itself. You know, if you were having a difficult mental health time before, kind of after engaging with the system, a lot of the times it comes out kind of worse. That's kind of one element of things. And I think all the wonderful solutions that Alex has mentioned are incredibly, incredibly important. Having that community autonomy and leadership is vital. I suppose kind of stepping back to kind of a broader systems type of overview around it, I would echo what Star mentioned before. I think medical education just really, really, really needs to be redone. In a certain way, it's been frustrating how slow the progress has been around it, because we know that this is such a huge community need. And you know, kind of my repeated message around it is that if we have all of those basic core competencies from the very beginning, no matter what role that particular health professional is going to play in the future, they're going to have at least the basics to work and advocate and not become part of the problem, if that kind of makes sense, not exacerbate those barriers. And I think that needs to apply across all kind of medical specialties, subspecialties, whatever else. We don't need just kind of more inclusive GPs. We need more inclusive everyone. We need a more inclusive system kind of period. And from my perspective, medical education is just needs to be an integral part of doing that. So if I had kind of one wish list, I suppose it would be to kind of completely redo the medical system so it doesn't come from that cis heteronormative colonial patriarchal lens around it. How do we go about getting that? I think education is one of them. Obviously, community voice and leadership is another kind of element around it. But really, the systems that are there need to work with us to make that a reality. And I absolutely value all the advocacy that people like Star, like Elle, like Alex are doing, because it's just so vital.
That's about all we've got time for. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. We're going to have some links up on our social media and also our website. That's 3cr.org.au/binarybusting. And they're going to point towards the House of Mutual Learning's fundraiser, because they're raising some money at the moment to help set up that project. And yeah, thanks everyone for joining. We've had Star Lady from the Zoe Bell Gender Collective. We've had El Void from Your Community Health, Dr. Aziel Arden-Sanchez from the Northside Clinic, and Alex Carf from the House of Mutual Learning. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining.
The Commons Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those campaigning for social change. It collects, curates and distributes the key lessons and resources of progressive movements around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 500 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org. The Commons Social Change Library is a 3CR.